can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
Yeah, welcome to Bird Calls, everybody, your weekly escape into the wonderful world of wild birds. I'm Chris Bozak, your host. Thanks for joining me. I'm here every Sunday from 1 to 2 on 1490 WGCH. In the wintertime is my personal favorite time to watch birds. If you're in the field, there's not as many crowds out. A lot of the fees are waived that you otherwise might incur going into our parks. And also, yeah, personally for me, I like my backyard bird watching in the winter the best as well, especially after a snowstorm. I mean, all seasons are good for watching the birds at your feeder, but you know, I personally like the winter the best. And we have a great show coming up with Twan Leenders. He's a conservation biologist for the Connecticut Audubon Society. He's going to talk about birds, of course, but also the reptiles and amphibians in Connecticut and throughout the world. But speaking of backyard bird watching, I wanted to bring in our friend Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited. He's got a place in Darien in Norton Heights and also in Bedford Hills. And we're going to talk about what to do in the wintertime for your backyard bird feeding. Are you there, Joe?
I am. Chris, how are you today?
Good. How's everything?
Everything's going just fine.
All right. So what are we looking for in the wintertime here for backyard bird watching?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. First of all, I agree with you. I think wintertime's a great time to go backyard bird watching. You look out and there's no leaves on the trees, so it's a lot easier to see a lot of the birds. They don't get hidden in the foliage. The other thing is there are some birds that are here in the winter that we don't see in the summertime. The dark-eyed junco is the one that comes to mind most readily. They spend their summers way up in the Arctic and up in northern Canada, and then they come down here for the winter. They think of this as being south, and they're a lot of people refer to them as the winter bird, the snowbird. They're a dark gray with a white breast, and you'll see them out in the snow. The other thing to keep in mind, birds in wintertime are looking for energy. So they want you want to feed them high fat content bird food, peanuts, sunflower seeds, things that have a very high fat content. And you want to put it in places, I always recommend that people, prior to the winter setting in, move their feeders closer to the house where they can see more readily during the cold weather. Look out, you know, places that you would be using in the summer for outdoor activities, you're not using so much in the winter. And so you can move the bird feeders into those locations and not worry about a conflict. And that allows you to get a better view of the birds that are in your backyard. Okay. The other thing that I talk to people about, winter can be a harsh time for bird watching. It's cold, it's wet, it's icy. If there are people who find it difficult to go out in the snow and the ice, this is a good time to think about taking a visit to your local art museum and use the art museum as a place to do your bird watching. And notice I said art museum, not a museum of natural history. We're not looking for stuffed birds, mounted birds. What we're looking for in an art museum is places where people use birds as part of their artistic representation.
That's
how are birds represented in paintings? If you go to something like the Museum of Natural History or the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you will find that there's rooms with furniture in it, and the furniture will have a bird motif on it. Some of the drawer pulls will be eagles. Some of the legs on the furniture will be bird talons. And, you know, you get a chance to go in and see those types of things. One of my favorite places to go is the Cloisters in New York. And you go look at the tapestries, and some of these tapestries have just incredibly beautiful representations of birds as part of the motif. So it's a good indoor place to go bird watching.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that. I know a lot of bird watchers, myself included, it's hard to, once you're into bird watching, it's hard to not be bird watching. Even if you're not out in the field looking for real birds, you do tend to notice when you see birds in art.
Yeah, and that's that's a great way to do it, is to go to a place, during the winter, wherever you are, and not just winter, summer too, but, you could be in a store, in lots of different types of stores, looking at merchandise, and in the back of your mind, thinking in terms of, what do people use bird motif for? Is it a motif on china? Is it a motif on linens? Because birds show up in lots and lots of different places, and a good bird watcher is going to be looking for those types of things.
And
it's especially significant in the winter because, again, you tend to spend much more time indoors in the winter than we do in the summertime.
Okay. I was at the famous swap shop in Darien.
Yes.
If you're not familiar with Darien, they have a swap shop at the dump, where if you have an item that is still usable, and rather than throw it in the landfill, you put it in there, and then whoever wants it just grabs it. So I went in there once, and there was a hot plate, I guess you call it. I'm not sure. It was something you put a pot holder, I guess. And it had two red-breasted mergansers on it. And I was thinking, who would give this away? It's perfect.
That's the kind of thing you look for in places like that.
Mm-hmm. So that, of course, came home with me, and it's proudly displayed in my kitchen right now.
Well, Chris, you know me. I would like to talk all day, but unfortunately, I do have... I'm actually in my store right now.
Oh, good.
And fortunately, I have customers in my store.
That is a good thing, Joe.
It really is. And we appreciate folks. If anybody hears the radio show, come stop by and visit us. We're at 356 Heights Road across from the Noroten Heights Railroad Station. And anybody who comes in and mentions the radio program gets a free 5-pound bag of bird seed.
So all right.
Come visit us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Chris, have a good one. Take care.
All right. We will talk to you soon.
You got it, buddy. Bye-bye.
All right. And that's Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited. He and Pat have two places, one in Darien, one in Bedford Hills. This show is also sponsored by Outdoor Sports Center in Wilton, Route 7. Be sure and check that out for, bird watching needs and any outdoor needs, really. They have lots of good gear and clothing that you need. It's cold out there when you're bird watching, so make sure you get the right kind of protection on your body, and you can find all that at Outdoor Sports Center, Route 7 in Wilton. As I said, we will have a little later in the show, Twan Leenders. He's a conservation biologist for Connecticut Audubon Society, but he's traveled all over the world studying birds and also reptiles and amphibians, so we'll definitely talk about birds, but we'll get into what some of our other wildlife in Connecticut is doing as well. If you miss a show, don't worry about it. Go to birdcallsradio.com. That's birdcallsradio.com. That's my blog, but it's also got all the radio archives on it. So we've been here for a while now, so we've got lots of good podcasts or archives, I guess you would call them, on there. So, yeah, as I mentioned, winter is a great time for backyard bird watching. Joe mentioned some of the seeds you can get, but just to see the contrast of the birds against the snow, especially when the cardinals come visiting, and Joe mentioned the juncos, the dark-eyed juncos, or the males are really black and white, and the females are a little more brownish or grayish and white. But it's really great to see the contrast, especially after a good snowstorm. And then the birds really come flocking to your feeders. You get several cardinals at once, and the blue jays stop by, and the mourning doves and juncos and white-throated sparrows are all over the ground, and even some of the woodpeckers come. I had a northern flicker at my feeder last winter after a snowstorm. Flickers aren't known to come to feeders too often, but this one was apparently hungry enough after the storm that he came and visited. That was neat. The other thing happens more in the wintertime at your feeders is sometimes those little birds, don't quite make it because there's a hawk around. There's a sharp-shinned hawk or a Cooper's hawk around that, you know, they don't eat seeds and fruit. They eat living things. They eat the smaller birds. So the sharp-shins will go after the juncos or the sparrows, and the Cooper's hawks, which are a little bigger, will go after things like doves and, you know, even some of the smaller birds. Last Christmas Day, we had a, my son Will, he was four at the time, he said, "Look, Daddy, there's a bird in the on the porch and right outside our, the glass door leading out to the porch, right outside on the other side was a Cooper's hawk eating a mourning dove." So we, you know, rather than hide the kids from it, we gave them a lesson in nature. That's what happens, you know. Some birds eat seeds, some birds eat other birds, some birds eat little mammals. So it's all part of nature, and it's been that way for a long time, far longer than we've been around. So, you know, it's a good little lesson in nature for him. So again, thank you for tuning into Bird Calls. We're going to take a little break here, but we'll be back with Twan Leenders, conservation biologist for Connecticut Audubon Society. Going to have lots of fascinating things to talk about with Twan. And we'll be back with more Bird Calls after these short messages here on 1490 WGCH.
Welcome to the wild. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no-waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
Be ready for the winter season by visiting Outdoor Sports Center on Route 7 in Wilton. Outdoor Sports Center offers full-season ski and snowboard packages for all ages. Ski the slopes with apparel and accessories from Arc'teryx, Patagonia, The North Face, Burton, and more. Outdoor Sports Center, Route 7 in Wilton. Complete selections of ski and snowboarding equipment, rentals, apparel, and accessories. Visit us online at OutdoorSportsCenter.com or call 203-762-8797.
Kimry Group is a boutique media service agency helping Fortune 500 corporations, nonprofits, and local businesses in all aspects of advertising, photography, and promotions. Kimry Photo includes assignments, stock images from 1925 to 2011, consulting, permissions, photo editing, and research, as well as multimedia presentations. Kimry Media creates and executes activity for advertising, digital media, and sponsorship. To succeed and show how you can make a difference and get noticed, visit KimryGroup.com. That's K-Y-M-R-Y group.com or contact Marty Welch Dickinson at 203-846-0359.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak inviting you to check out BirdCallsRadio.com. It's the official internet home of the Bird Calls Radio program, heard right here on 1490 WGCH from 1 to 2 p.m. every Sunday. Bird Calls is your weekly look at the wonderful world of wild birds with regular features and expert guests. BirdCallsRadio.com supports the show with bird blog postings, show archives, a Contact Me button where you can send in questions for the show, and a special page for potential advertisers to learn how to support Bird Calls Radio. So check out BirdCallsRadio.com and feel free to drop me a line.
Now back to Bird Calls with my dad, Chris Bozak.
Well, I like birds.
And hey, welcome back to Bird Calls, everybody. It's a fun little session with Joe Warren earlier. Bird Calls comes at you every 1 to 2 on Sundays at 1490 WGCH. And if you miss any shows, go to birdcallsradio.com and you can check it out there. As promised, we have Twan Leenders. He's a conservation biologist for the Connecticut Audubon Society, among other things. He's a herpetologist, which means he studies reptiles and amphibians. And he's also big into birds and all kinds of nature. So welcome to the show, Twan.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Now, I saw a blog that you posted in November. It was a snowy owl, and you had some fantastic photos. So first of all, tell me about the snowy owl showing up, and also tell me about, I guess you were doing a waterfowl survey. So what types of things were you seeing on that day?
Okay. Yeah, we Connecticut Audubon Society has been working with the DuPont Corporation since late 2008 at Stratford Point, and we currently act as the site managers for the property. And as part of our responsibilities, we carry out daily waterfowl monitoring studies, and we do some selective hazing of some of the waterfowl if it ends up in places where we don't necessarily want it. And this is all sort of the result of a long history at the site. The site was originally a trap and skeet shooting club owned by Remington Arms in the 1940s. The DuPont Corporation acquired Remington, the whole kit and caboodle, and ended up with the gun club as well, the old Remington Gun Club, as the site was formerly known. And as you can imagine, the site, as it was operational, with I believe they had 19 stations set up to do trap and skeet shooting there. And it was operational for a good 60 years or so. So quite a bit of lead shot had accumulated in the environment there over time. And the club was closed in the 1980s. And at that point, DuPont actually did not own the Remington Corporation anymore, but they ended up being held responsible for the environmental cleanup of the site. Mm. And the bulk of that has been done in the year 2000 and 2001. A large-scale remediation was carried out by DuPont. Massive operation. They literally mapped every single rock on the site.
Oh, wow.
And excavated down to the till, pretty much all of the upland area, 23 acres of it, of the 28 acres upland, I think something in the order of 24, 26 acres surrounding the site, going below the low tide line as far as they can reach. Excavated all the soil, ran it all through this essentially a modified gold mining operation where the suspended soil and suspended in water was run through the machinery and through these giant rotating drums, and just the selective weight of the lead shot is so much heavier, so much denser than the soil, that the lead could get filtered out, and the cleaned up sediment would then be put back where it came from. And,
okay.
Once they're all done, they put all the rocks back where they originally mapped them, and that took care of most of the lead. They removed something in the order of 320 tons of lead shot.
Oh, wow.
Pellets. A massive, massive operation.
Mm.
But the technology just simply does not exist to remove all of it. The site was cleaned up to spec. I believe there is something in the order of a half a shot per liter of the sediment and water mixture going back to the site that was going back, which is twice as clean as was required by law.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine, and these hundreds of thousands of gallons of water going through, if you still have like half a shot on average per liter of water and soil coming back, there's still some left.
Mm-hmm.
So since the large-scale remediation, DuPont has still been cleaning up the leftover hot spots of lead. What happened was that when the sediment was put back on the intertidal zone, especially the beach, wherever the mixture of water and soil would come out of the big pipes, just because of the selective weight of the lead again, the lead shot would drop straight out of the pipe, whereas the sediment would sort of spread out a distance from the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that nobody really anticipated. This particular cleanup was sort of a groundbreaking, first of its kind environmental cleanup of a shooting range or a gun club, and it's a huge deal right now. There are clubs being cleaned up all over the place, with the added disadvantage that it was actually on the water, so you have all these other logistical problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
So 2020 hindsight, the return of the sediment to its original location on the beach sort of led to these superficial hot spots of lead. So those have been surveyed in. They come back. DuPont comes back four times a year, and they do surveys trying to find the remaining hot spots. And over the past 10 years, every time anything's been found, it's sort of mapped in, and during a narrow window when operations can take place on the beach where it wouldn't impact any of the local resources or wildlife, like oyster spawnings or plovers breeding, there's a narrow window in which permits will be issued to do work on the intertidal zone, and these hotspots have been removed. So over the course of a good 10, 15 years or so, really most of the lead has been removed. And we're now at the point where we're starting to think a little bit beyond remediation, and we're starting to look at restoration of the site and sort of trying to get back to a natural state.
Yeah.
But to go back to the birds, one of the things that we do is we carry out daily waterfowl surveys to figure out what kind of ducks and shorebirds were mostly are present in the area that was historically covered by falling lead shot, to see what the potential impact could be on the birds that actually occupy the site. So even though there is no exposed lead on the surface right now, we still want to make sure that if other hotspots are discovered, that we know what the potential impact might be on birds in the area. So we're looking at their presence. We map in exactly in this big grid that we've created on the site where these birds are. We try to figure out what they are, how many there are, what they're doing, if they're feeding there, if they're just sleeping there, and really just really do a really detailed risk assessment of what potentially might be going on.
Okay. Now, I know enough about... I know enough only to know that obviously lead's not good for wildlife and stuff. And, you know, I, you know, have done stories through my newspaper on, you know, the impact of loons and lead shot and, you know, with, you know, abandoned fishing lining and stuff. So what exactly is the danger that lead poses to wildlife?
The lead shot that's in the environment there is pretty much inert. Some of the lead shot that I've seen removed from the sediments there is pretty much still in the same shape that it was when it was shot. You can literally pack these pellets back into a cartridge and shoot them again. So it's not like it's dissolving and leaching into the environment. The actual hazard, the potential hazard that might exist there is when you have direct ingestion of the pellets, so animals actually physically eating the lead. And you might think that that's not a big hazard because most animals wouldn't prefer to eat lead shot, but it actually turns out that especially dabbling ducks, ducks have no teeth, you know, so they often eat grains and seeds and things like that that they pick up from the sediment. And in order to crack the hulls on these seeds, they actually use small pebbles that they have in their gizzard, sort of a suction in their esophagus. And before they actually swallow the food, it actually passes through this muscular section of their throat where they have some little pebbles and some stones stored in there that they use to grind up the grains and things that go into their digestive tract before they can digest them.
Okay.
And it turns out that the actual size of a pellet of lead from lead shot tends to be the preferred size for these animals to pick up for grit. So they actually look at little pebbles and other things that are that size to swallow and keep it in their system. So not only does it go, not only do they swallow it, but they actually store it in a section of their digestive tract where it stays in the system for a longer time.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then it gets dissolved in their blood, and it leads to all kinds of health issues, liver damage, potential brain damage. That once they have a lead in their system, the consequences are usually pretty bad and pretty rapid.
Okay. All right. But must have been pretty neat to see the owl there. Is that the first time you've seen that
absolutely.
Spot?
Yeah, absolutely. No, they pass by there. We get snowy owls almost every winter. They don't always come down. We have eruption years where they come down in good numbers like this year. Last year was not a great year for snowy owls, and I think we only had one or two sightings for the whole state that winter.
That's it. Okay.
But the winter before that, we had at least three or four different individuals passing through Stratford Point, and they often tend to hang out there for a while.
Mm-hmm. What kind of camera did you use to capture those images on your blog?
I use a Nikon digital SLR with a 300 millimeter lens. It was very close. It was right in the seawall.
Okay.
Sort of tucked in from the wind behind rocks, and it was perfectly happy to sit there with people watching at a safe distance.
Yeah, that's good. Well, so now that I brought it up and alerted people to the photos, what do you know the exact web address people can go to, or how would they find those photos if they wanted to?
Those photos are on our blog, and the address to our blog is ctaudubon.blogspot.com.
Okay, all right, yeah, a lot of interesting things. You're just one of the bloggers, right? Are there other people?
Yeah, Scott Krubosch is one of the main contributors. Mm-hmm. We try to keep things going. We really intended to be a blog for the entire organization, but it turns out that our Science and Conservation Office seems to be quite busy all the time, and we always have a lot of things that we want to share with the rest of the world. So there's a lot of information there, and we try to keep try to keep it up to date. We try to post things there, relevant things to projects that we're doing, things that we find out, that we hear about, that we learn as we're doing our work out there that we think might interest people and what an interest in conservation and in birds. But it's not just focused on birds either. Sometimes we have some policy announcements and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We try to cover quite a broad scope of topics there.
Okay. Yeah, they're always interesting. This being the winter of 2011-2012, this winter we seem to be having a lot of sightings of razorbills this year. Any theories on why they might be coming down here more often?
Yeah, there's been some discussion about that. It's really hard to tell. And there could be a short-term pattern that sort of drives them in here. One of the ideas floating out there is that potentially we have a recovery or just a very high population of bait fish and small, several-size fish that these alphas feed on. So they're starting to move into the Long Island Sound some more just because there's more food available. There are all kinds of different patterns that could take place there. It could be a climate-related issue. It could be just a short-term thing. It might just happen this year and may not ever happen again. But bird populations change all the time. We have all kinds of species in Connecticut that historically weren't here, but they're gradually moving into the area and they're here to stay. Things like red-bellied woodpeckers and Carolina wrens and tufted titmice were far less common 10, 20, 30 years ago, sort of gradually moving northward. And other species are potentially moving in other directions. Also have sort of shorter-term patterns like the snowy owls that some years will come down in large numbers and some years you won't see them at all. And those are often direct result of population spikes to the north of us, where suddenly you have too many snowy owls to support in a specific habitat, and they just sort of gradually get pushed out. You got these teenagers that get pushed out of moms and dads' territories because it's there, and they're going to start to explore the world and try to find potential other places to settle. And if the conditions are right, they might move in for a while, and then conditions might change for the worse, and they just decide to pack their bags and leave again.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we talked about a couple of different types of birds, and you're the former editor-in-chief of the Connecticut State of the Birds, and I'm sure still involved with that project.
Yeah.
So in general, what is the state of the birds in Connecticut? Are we doing well here? Are we not doing well?
We're doing pretty well for a small state, but, there's always ways we can change things. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we're facing is that we have to really figure out what it is that we want to accomplish in the state, what it is that we truly can accomplish for birds and other wildlife in the state and for habitats, and then figure out how we get there. And that's one of the main things I think that we're still working on, trying to fine-tune. Across the board in Connecticut, people are very conservation-minded, and people believe in protecting species and protecting habitats. But there's really not much of a very specific plan in place to figure out what exactly it is that we should be protecting and how we get there.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas on what that plan should be or what you would like to see that plan be?
Well, I would like to have a better idea on what we already have in terms of protected land in the state. I would like to have a better feel for what's actually being protected by these parcels that often exist as just boundaries on a map with vegetation in them, but often we don't really have a good idea of what is actually special about these places, what is in there, what should be in there, and how the quality of the habitat is. A lot of the state is forested, as you all know. The state is, I think, pushing 60% habitat if you look at the maps. And then often these assessments are made based off satellite imagery where they look at tree covers and anything of a specific density is labeled forest. But just because we label it forest doesn't necessarily mean that it is a functional forest that actually provides the resources and the habitat for animals and plants that rely on the forest. So we need to look at a little more sophisticated level at what we have. And for example, if we stick with the forest, figure out whether we'd be better served by having, for example, fewer larger blocks of forest versus lots of smaller scattered plots of forest.
Okay.
There are advantages to both, but across the board, the smaller plots are more sensitive to disturbance and edge effects where you have invasive plants coming in on the edges, and the edges are usually bordered by development, so you have different climate conditions when you have backyards there where the habitat is open and you get more sunlight coming in, the conditions get drier and sunnier and warmer, which then favor specific species that are usually more adaptable, ornamental plants, invasive plants, but not necessarily the kind of plants that you would like to have in a forest that would be a good habitat for a forest interior bird, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking at, for example, our endangered species list, and we look at the bird species on that list, there are about, I think there are 52 species of birds on our Connecticut's endangered and threatened species list. And the bulk of those are on that list, mostly because their habitat is just in very, very short supply in the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The bulk of these species are coastal species that need quality coastal habitat, there's quite a bit of competition over the prime coastal land.
Mm-hmm.
Salt marshes have greatly reduced in size over the last century, and then species relying on salt marshes are hurting from that, and now they're also being threatened by potential rises in sea level as well that could potentially flood the salt marshes. And in an ideal world and in historic times, these salt marshes would gradually sort of move inland in the higher reaches as the water level goes up. But those higher reaches are now all paved and built up, so there's really nowhere to go for these habitats. So they're shrinking from both ends pretty much, both
mm-hmm.
from the seaside and from the land side.
All right. Now, obviously, I want as many birds as possible in Connecticut, and it's important that we have these birds. But say just to throw it out there, I want to see how you answer this. So the Connecticut, I think, either endangered or threatened, you know, some of the egrets or some bird that may be common in the United States and not really threatened as a species overall in the United States, but is threatened in Connecticut. Why is it important to make that distinction?
Well, when you try to be somewhat pragmatic about it, it's a very, very valid question to ask. There are species on our threatened and endangered species list that are very rare in Connecticut, but that across the board and population-wise are doing just fine. So you got to wonder, like obviously nobody wants to lose species from the mm-hmm. state, but it becomes more of a personal issue than a conservation issue there. Like, can we afford to lose species for the state? In some cases, it wouldn't really affect the population as a whole. It would be sad if we don't have them in Connecticut anymore, but is it really bad for the species as a whole? When you're being realistic about it, the amount of resources and funding available for conservation is very limited. So if you're going to have to put your conservation dollars somewhere, it would be smarter to put your conservation dollars in places where we can truly make a difference as a state and focus on species that are an important component of the Connecticut wildlife. If you look at, for example, barn owls are very rare in the state. They're a state endangered species, and there's maybe a handful of them in the state. They may or may not have bred in the last year. But the long and the short of it is their population is very small. Now, the barn owl is a cosmopolitan species. You can find the same barn owl in Australia and Africa and South America. They're all over the world. So if we would allocate a lot of resources to protecting barn owls, and we would be able to double our Connecticut population, we might go from one handful to two handfuls. But on the grand scheme of things, for the world's population, it doesn't really make a difference at all. Now, there's another species that a lot of money is being spent on, and it's relatively easy to put up a few boxes in the right places.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, that would be a species that, even though it's very rare in the state, it would not be a species that I think it would be smart to spend a lot of money on protecting.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, on the flip side, though, if you look at, for example, the salt marsh sparrows and the seaside sparrows, a huge chunk of the world's breeding population uses the salt marshes in southern New England, and the individuals breeding in our salt marshes in the state make up a really significant portion of the entire world's breeding population. So that
okay.
was something that we should focus on, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a habitat that, as you mentioned before, we're losing, so we got to...
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So that should be a conservation priority as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, good. Well, we need to take a little break here, but we'll be back with more with Twan Leenders. He's a conservation biologist for Connecticut Audubon Society, and he's also a herpetologist. I want to get into some reptiles and amphibian questions, too. So hang with us here on Bird Calls Radio, and we'll be right back here on 1490 WGCH.
Welcome to the wild. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
Be ready for the winter season by visiting Outdoor Sports Center on Route 7 in Wilton. Outdoor Sports Center offers full-season ski and snowboard packages for all ages. Ski the slopes with apparel and accessories from Arc'teryx, Patagonia, The North Face, Burton, and more. Outdoor Sports Center, Route 7 in Wilton. Complete selections of ski and snowboarding equipment, rentals, apparel, and accessories. Visit us online at OutdoorSportsCenter.com or call 203-762-8797.
Kimry Group is a boutique media service agency helping Fortune 500 corporations, nonprofits, and local businesses in all aspects of advertising, photography, and promotions. Kimry Photo includes assignments, stock images from 1925 to 2011, consulting, permissions, photo editing, and research, as well as multimedia presentations. Kimry Media creates and executes activity for advertising, digital media, and sponsorship. To succeed and show how you can make a difference and get noticed, visit KimryGroup.com. That's K-Y-M-R-Y group.com or contact Marty Welch Dickinson at 203-846-0359.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak inviting you to check out BirdCallsRadio.com. It's the official internet home of the Bird Calls Radio program, heard right here on 1490 WGCH from 1 to 2 p.m. every Sunday. Bird Calls is your weekly look at the wonderful world of wild birds with regular features and expert guests. BirdCallsRadio.com supports the show with bird blog postings, show archives, a Contact Me button where you can send in questions for the show, and a special page for potential advertisers to learn how to support Bird Calls Radio. So check out BirdCallsRadio.com and feel free to drop me a line.
Now back to Bird Calls with my dad, Chris Bozak.
Birds.
And welcome back to Bird Calls, everybody. I'm Chris Bozak, your host. We're sponsored by Wild Birds Unlimited in Darien and Bedford Hills, and also Outdoor Sports Center in Wilton, Route 7. So check those places out for some bird watching needs that you have and clothing needs. We are here with Twan Leenders, conservation biologist for Connecticut Audubon Society, and also a herpetologist, which is someone who studies reptiles and amphibians. And it being the winter, Twan, where are the reptiles and amphibians? What do they do during the winter?
All of ours are currently underground, hiding somewhere and sitting out the cold. And we'll start seeing them again as soon as the snow starts melting and ice is off the water. Our local amphibians and reptiles are very seasonal, some more than others, but all of them will be hibernating right now.
Okay. And some just at the bottom of a pond, I guess that's where some of the turtles hang out. Where are the snakes?
Yeah, the turtles and some of the frogs will actually go at the bottom of the pond, and they actually they cool down their body temperatures enough that their metabolism is at such a low level that they can actually survive completely submersed for 6 months in some cases.
Okay.
And they just absorb enough oxygen from their environment through their skin to keep going. Snakes, for example, are most likely a little ways underground below the frost line. In the summer and the spring and fall, you'll see them out in the open basking in the sun. And if it gets too warm, they often end up just hiding under vegetation and under leaves, and the air temperature is warm enough that they can just absorb enough heat from their environment without actually having to expose themselves, which is greatly reducing their risk of getting eaten by something passing by.
Mm-hmm. So they get, obviously they're not fish, they don't have gills, they need to get some oxygen. There's enough in that environment where they can get the oxygen they need.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. They actually they managed to slow down their metabolism and their heart rate to the point that they just need enough oxygen to keep their systems going. And in some cases, like our wood frogs, for example, are a famous example of that. They actually they're one of the first amphibians to emerge in the spring or even sometimes in late winter. And in order to do that, they actually hibernate closer to the surface than all of the other amphibians that would go farther down. But they do run the risk and often actually are subject to freezing. They literally freeze solid.
Oh, wow.
So their blood freezes, their heart completely stops and everything. And in most animals, if that would happen, the water component in your blood would actually freeze first and form ice crystals. And ice crystals are relatively sharp, and they would physically damage the capillaries, like the smallest blood vessels in your system,
mm-hmm.
and cause all kinds of internal bleeding and pain. And usually it would end very badly for those animals. But wood frogs actually are one of the few animals that produce a glycoprotein in their body that acts as an antifreeze. And they essentially don't form these sharp crystals and manage to freeze and still not sustain any permanent damage to their system. So by the time they thaw out in the spring, they're the first ones going again. They can actually get going at a very low body temperature.
Okay.
And since they're much closer to the surface, they're the first ones out again.
All right. How do they know when to go under in the fall, and how do they know when to come back up in the spring?
It's a combination of day length and temperatures. Some of you may have heard this is sometimes really nice sunny days in late fall and November. You might even hear some spring peepers calling in the woods sometimes. They're already in their places where they're hibernating, but somehow the combination of the right day length and night length and the temperatures makes them think it's spring and they just start calling already. But usually it doesn't last very long.
Okay. All right. Now let's get back to snakes. Obviously we have the... there's not many poisonous snakes in Connecticut, but we have a couple. How likely are we to come across them, and what types are there?
We have 14 different kinds of snakes in the state, and two of them are venomous. Those are the copperhead and the timber rattlesnake. Timber rattlesnakes are isolated in two different sections of the state, and there are very few of them left. They're not doing well. They're isolated populations. They used to be more widespread, but they've also been hunted fairly heavily because a lot of people, like starting from the early European colonists on, have been decimating their populations because they're afraid of them. And they also have the added disadvantage that they're essentially top predators, much like lions and tigers would be in their appropriate ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
And often these are animals that are by default and in lower densities anyway. And they're found here very close to the northern edge of their range, so their activity period is fairly short. And as a result, they reproduce very slowly. So it takes them a long time to mature, and then they don't produce babies every year. So losing especially adult females from a population makes a huge dent. Even losing one adult female from a population can really put a big damper on the ability of this population to replenish itself, because it just takes a long time to produce enough offspring that will survive into adulthood again.
Okay.
So these rattlesnakes right now are isolated, and one population is in the northwest corner of the state, pretty much along the New York-Connecticut boundary, roughly where the Appalachian Trail sort of runs through the state. It's
okay.
A good indicator. And then there's a second isolated population of rattlesnakes in the uplands near the Connecticut River, sort of in the Glastonbury area.
So what kind of numbers are we looking at? Are there 10, 100, or is it hard to tell?
It's hard to tell. Probably, I don't know, it's hard to put a number on that. We're probably looking at several dozens, probably more than, it depends. If you start adding in the babies that are born every year, you get sort of a temporary spike in the population because they do produce quite a few babies if they do actually have offspring. But as a rule, the majority of those babies don't really make it into maturity, so the population sort of fluctuates like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Copperheads are much more common in the state, but they're extremely secretive and very well camouflaged, so they're actually probably quite a bit more widespread than we think they are. Just people just don't see them.
Okay. Now, they hang out in around rocks and under stone walls and things. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're really a woodland species. Copperheads are often hibernating in talus lobes and rock piles and things like that. So they tend to gather there in the spring and the fall when they're either going into hibernation or coming out of it, and then they disperse from there throughout the year and sort of disperse to their respective hunting grounds. So they sort of scatter all over the forest. And they're patterned. They're beautiful snakes, but they're classic, what we call sit and wait predators. They're animals that don't eat very often, but when they do eat something, they often tend to eat something that's relatively large compared to their own body size.
Mm-hmm.
And they, rather than spending energy just cruising around and trying to find things to eat, they'd rather just sit and stay put in a place that smells like potential prey might be walking by there. Mm-hmm. So they find these little wildlife trails and sort of sit on the side. So they don't move very much. They often sort of sit half concealed in the leaf litter, maybe under some vegetation, and they just sort of sit and wait for something edible to come within striking distance. And if it does, they'll eat it, and if it doesn't, they'll just wait. And
okay.
They can wait for a long time. Some of these what we call pit vipers, they're vipers that have heat-sensitive pits in their faces that they can use to detect body heat of warm blood prey walking by. They essentially sit in the same place sometimes for months on end without eating anything. And just because they do that, they don't really use up very much energy either, so they can afford to do that as well.
Okay. Now, how much danger do they pose to people? First of all, you're probably not going to find one, but if you do happen to overturn a rock and there is one, what you know, are they likely to strike, or do you have to provoke it to strike? And what happens if they do bite you?
Well, in terms of danger, I wouldn't worry about it here in Connecticut. The rattlesnakes, in terms of the strength of their venom, should be considered more dangerous than the copperheads. But the rattlesnakes live in pretty isolated areas, and especially in the Northwest Hills, they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. The odds of encountering one are pretty slim. Timber rattlesnakes are very, very shy animals. It's not very easy to provoke them to bite. And across the board, really, most snakes will prefer to get away from potential danger than trying to attack. And you got to keep in mind too that especially for venomous snakes, they don't have that venom to pester people who happen to be stepping on them. They would use it as a defensive mode, but really it's there to help them immobilize these relatively large prey that they're trying to catch.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes at a risk for them too. Like there's some of these venomous snakes and these pit vipers. There are records of pit vipers eating prey that's bigger than their own body size by weight. So they'll eat something very big.
Mm.
And you got to imagine that this is an animal that doesn't have arms or legs and has no other means of defending itself. So it's going to have to catch its food with its mouth, and it's going to catch something that might be even bigger than itself, and it's going to have to somehow subdue this thing without getting hurt in the process. So the venom is generally evolved to either paralyze the prey so that it wouldn't struggle and scrape or scratch or bite the snake. And especially in vipers, they have these relatively long fangs that sort of work as hypodermic needles, and the venom gets injected in the inside of the prey. So it also acts as an aid to help the digestion. You can imagine like trying to swallow something that's bigger than yourself without using forks and knife and hands and just swallowing it whole.
Yeah.
You're going to have this big lump in your body that you would like to have reduced in size as soon as possible so you can start moving around again because you want to get out of harm's way. So the venom actually helps to digest the prey from the inside out so that the big lump goes down faster.
Okay.
But as a result, if you do get bitten by one of those things, the thing is that you end up with a mixture of different chemicals in a venom that is A, meant to paralyze and kill your prey, so that's usually not a good thing for you. And B, it's also meant to reduce the size of the prey, so it's often full of all kinds of digestive enzymes and such. So it often does local damage as well. It causes damage to your tissues as well. So any bites by either a copperhead or a timber rattlesnake, you would definitely want to go see a doctor, go to
yeah.
the hospital and get treated for it. But the reality of it is that copperheads actually, I don't believe there are any documented fatalities from copperhead bites anywhere in the world. And timber rattlesnakes,
oh, really?
they're a little bit more dangerous, but across the board, those bites usually end up pretty well as well, especially if you get medical attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, there's a component in copperhead venom that actually led to the discovery of medication to treat epilepsy.
Okay.
Yeah, historically, an epilepsy patient, somebody who was suffering from a seizure, actually sustained a copperhead bite somewhere down south and realized years down the road that ever since he got bitten by a copperhead, he had not had any seizures. And that led him to some research, and they actually isolated a component from copperhead venom that's still used as a medicine to treat epileptic seizures.
Oh, wow. That's a good example of wanting to keep all our species around,
exactly.
Not lose anything. So now you've traveled around the world studying reptiles and amphibians. Have you ever been bitten by a snake?
Yes, many times, but never by anything dangerous.
Okay.
I'm extremely, extremely careful with those because I have traveled quite extensively. Most of my herpetological work has taken place in the tropics, and I often ended up working in areas that were very isolated. I'd be running expeditions for all kinds of conservation organizations or universities, and we'd be in areas that had not been explored previously, so we would often be in parts of the world where if anything would happen, odds are nobody would ever find us again. So that'll make you very careful doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll get into your travels in a little bit, but back in Connecticut, something that can be dangerous is, I have two boys, 5 and 8, and we were taking a walk in this summer, and the 8-year-old ran up ahead, as kids like to do sometimes, and he started yelling in a good way. He's like, "Dad, come quick, let's look at this." And I go there, and he's trying to pick up a snapping turtle that was in the trail between two ponds. Like, just be careful. So that, I imagine those can be dangerous if not handled properly.
Yeah. Although a lot of the stories surrounding those animals are pretty exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I would not recommend getting too close to the business end of an adult snapping turtle because they will definitely hurt you.
So that the question actually comes up. Sometimes readers of my column will send me an email saying they saw one in the road and they didn't know how to handle it. What is the best way, if you do have to handle a snapping turtle? What's the best way to do it? Say you see one in the road or something.
Okay, yeah. If you do have to handle it, like ideally, if you see one on the road, you can try to nudge it off the road if you can do this safely without getting hit by the traffic. But historically, people always thought that you can pick up a snapping turtle by its tail. They have a long tail. And that would put you pretty far away from its head, which is true, but unfortunately snapping turtles, especially adult ones, are quite heavy. They can weigh in the order of 35 or so, even more pounds, and if you pick up that kind of weight by its tail, that could lead to all kinds of injuries to the turtle as well.
Okay.
So that's usually not a good idea. The other disadvantage of doing that is that people pick up the snapping turtle by the tail, and as you all know, these are pretty large animals, so imagine carrying a snapping turtle by the tail and thinking that your fingers are safe from the head, but most people don't think about their ankles and feet, which are right next to the giant head that's dangling there. So people tend to get hurt in other places doing that. You definitely don't want to pick up a snapping turtle like you would any other turtle by just grabbing the sides of the shell.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have a very long neck, and they can extend their neck easily back halfway down the shell. So if you put your fingers there, they will get hurt. Probably the safest way to handle a snapping turtle is either to grab it by the hind legs, if you can, or actually grab the the back edge of the shell right above where the hind legs are and lift them up like that so you can carry a turtle with the head facing away from you.
Okay.
It's not always easy because they are heavy and big animals.
Yeah. Well, I heard some people, like if they have a shovel or something in their, happen to have a shovel in their car or truck, they can use it that way. Does that usually work?
Yeah, that should work. Yeah. I wouldn't lift it up too high, so if it does fall, it might crack the shell. But again, if you've got a 35-pound turtle on the end of a shovel, it's a...
Okay.
Not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, that's true. Now, we only have a couple minutes left, but I need to get to this question. So I read that you lived in a treehouse in the rainforest. Tell me about that.
Okay. It's true, though. As part of my doctoral research, I ended up deciding to study the reptiles and amphibians of the rainforest canopy. Earlier on in my studies, I ended up meeting... this researcher, Dr. Donald Perry, who invented a portable technique to actually get into the treetops in the rainforest using a crossbow and fishing line and weighted arrows. You shoot a pilot line over a branch, and then you make the arrow come back down with the weights, and you tie a parachute cord to it, and you pull it back, and you sort of repeat the process with heavier ropes, and then eventually you can tie in climbing ropes and use this modified climbing gear to actually... shimmy up into the canopy and work up there. The interesting thing about the rainforest canopy is that it's this whole different story over your head. It's like 100 feet over your head. And there are animals and plants up there that, unless a tree falls down, never really come down out of their own volition. There's a whole different climate up there compared to the forest floor. Like you get sun exposure. It's drier. It's warmer. It's sunnier.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating.
It's a whole different world up there that we just don't know anything about.
Yeah.
And, yeah, my problem was that I ended up studying animals that often end up being active at night. And I used to work in a rainforest area that is one of the wettest places in the world. We would easily receive something in the order of 11 to 12 meters of rain a year.
So
35 feet of rain a year. So you can imagine trying to do this kind of work 100 to 200 feet above the ground, dangling from pieces of rope at night in the driving rain, not great.
Yeah.
So I ended up starting to build platforms with roofs over them and sort of ended up finding some study trees that actually had really good populations of animals that I was studying, and I decided that since I was always carrying thousands of dollars worth of camera gear and recording equipment and all that around, that I ended up building myself a little treehouse, so I at least had a drier place to work from and just work at night and get a little bit of sleep every once in a while, too. I used to try to tie myself to branches, and you got to imagine these are branches that are wide enough to drive a bicycle on if you want.
Yeah, wow.
But still, you're tied to a branch, and you're trying to get some sleep, and you're like 150 feet off the ground.
Not fun. All right. Well, I'm glad I got that that question in. Unfortunately, we're about out of time. But if you go to a search engine, say Google, and type in Twan Leenders, that's TWANLEENDERS, you'll come up with all kinds of fascinating photos that he's taken and learn more about him. He's got some really great reptiles, amphibian photos, bird photos. So be sure and check that out. So thanks for being with us, Twan.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I'd like to thank my sponsors again, Wild Birds Unlimited and Outdoor Sports Center. And we'll see you next Sunday here on Bird Calls on 1490 WGCH.